Our guest today is Johnny Rashid. What? You okay, Kathy?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Kathy.
I tell my sons to be quiet, and what do? They go in the kitchen to eat.
They're moving chairs around.
All right. Take four. Welcome back to the Fascinating Podcast. This is episode number 329. I'm J.R. Forresteros.
I'm Kathy Kong.
And I'm Matt Michalotis.
Just Michalotis this week, huh?
I know.
That's right. And together we are the Fascinating Podcast.
The Fascinating Podcast plus Clay, who I think is at the dentist right now. Is that right, Kathy?
That's what he says.
Now, I don't share other people's medical
I forget what it was.
Though.
A crown?
Did he come see Peter, or is he just seeing some lesser dentist down here in Dallas?
Some lesser dentist down there in Texas.
Oh, okay. Man. Do they even have dentists in Texas, or they just give you whiskey and a stick to bite on?
Ooh.
Yeah, is that not how dentistry works?
I have never been offered whiskey at the dentist's office. That would make it even better.
Oh, you know that mouthwash they give you? That's whiskey.
That's really bad whiskey.
Just swallow.
And it's green.
Yeah.
Hey, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Let's hear it.
If you remember when we had Ryan North on and he was talking about being a supervillain?
Yes.
Okay. So this is along those lines. If you had about, let's say, 1,000 feet worth of forest that you wanted to hide, where would you hide it?
Where would I hide it?
Do you think people would be unlikely to find it?
Stick it?
Yeah.
Under a magic cloak.
Oh, you have a I guess if you can steal a forest, you have a magic cloak too. Is it a cloak if it can hide 1,000-foot forest?
Yes.
I feel like that would
be
like a blanket.
She said magic cloak. JR.
Magic.
Keep up.
Okay.
It's magic.
Gosh. So it could be a tarp or a cloak or whatever.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Cloaks, they literally call the material yards.
Okay. Like,
yeah. Just keep going. Why? I put mine underwater. I hide it underwater.
It probably wouldn't last very long there, but this.
Forests need water?
Not that much water.
I'm guessing Krista takes care of most of the plants at your house, Matt.
She takes care of all the plants. Well, the trees. I take care of the trees.
So some cave explorers in South China found
underwater.
A prehistoric forest at the bottom of a giant sinkhole.
What? Prehistoric forest?
Wait.
Prehistoric forest. It's in Chinese, they're called Tian Keng, which means heavenly pit. And the sinkhole is 630 feet deep, which means it would hide the entire Washington Monument and still have room to spare. And so at the bottom of this were trees that were over 100 feet tall.
What?
Yeah. Craziness.
Wait.
And they're just like some.
Were there feathered dinosaur remains?
This is what I want to know, right? I want to know what they're not telling us in this news story.
Yeah, because they're just talking about trees.
Was there
That feels pretty safe, but I feel like they probably found other things.
Tomb or a
right?
person on a rock, anything like that?
Yeah, some
Still
sort of sword in a rock or something.
Yeah,
I don't know,
like big.
Again, there's a
dinosaur.
There's a lot of gaps between the lines of this story, and I don't know how they expect us not to read a lot into them.
And notice, if you haven't heard this story already, why not? Who's trying to keep us from hearing this story?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the kind of breaking news you expect from the Fascinating Podcast.
Yeah. Good job, us. / JR.
Anyway, I never get tired of the amazing ways the world surprises us. You know? And these were spelunkers that were exploring a cave system and like came out into the sinkhole with a prehistoric forest in it.
That's amazing. Very cool. Yeah.
They probably shouldn't have told anybody. Now everybody's going to go down there.
What would you do if you were in a cave, like 600 feet underground, and then you came upon a prehistoric forest? Like,
well,
I would
that's
for
the thing. I wouldn't be there in the beginning.
Good point.
Period. So.
Yeah, I was getting daylight down there.
They don't.
You know,
I'd
probably throw some Dorito wrappers around and then just leave. That's probably what I would do.
Why Dorito wrappers?
I don't know. That's what I always find out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, okay.
or like water bottles. There's always I go to the most like obscure places on earth. You're like, huh, someone got rid of their Coke can here.
So you've never been first somewhere is what I'm hearing you say.
I remember when I got to the moon and I was like, who left all this garbage here? Like flags and like pieces
looking
of
at you, Neil Armstrong.
Well, do we have a guest today?
We're going to talk about this for the next hour and a half, everybody. Strap
moon
in.
Dirt. Moon
places
trash.
I've found garbage in essence.
No. We have the privilege today of interviewing the pastor, Johnny Rashid, who pastors Circle of Hope, which is an Anabaptist cell church in Philadelphia. He hosts the Circle of Hope's Resist and Restore podcast, and he blogs at johnnyrashid.com. And he has a brand new book out called Jesus Takes Aside, Embracing the Political Demands of the Gospel, which is actually an even more challenging book than it sounds like, as you will hear in our interview. So why are you shaking your head, Matt?
Because it was an amazing interview.
Yeah.
So, I think multiple people cried during this episode.
Yeah. For sure, at least one did, but I think multiple people did.
I did. Johnny got a little choked up.
I got teary-eyed at the end.
Hear Kathy, but I was on video, so I got to see. And JR mentioned white tears, so that.
No, I think that was Kathy too.
I did.
Oh, you're
right.
I
mentioned white tears.
I laughed at them.
Oh, man, you're right.
Well, it is a great interview, so let's hop over to our conversation with Johnny. Our guest today is Johnny Rashid. Johnny, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
So happy to be here.
So we always ask our first-time guests, what is something just in life in general that fascinates you?
Oh, this is a good question. This is a random thing that comes to mind, but it seems to me like dragons in ancient cultures developed independent of one another.
Interesting.
So like, does that mean there were real dragons? Like, what is that? Like, there's in European folklore, there's dragons, in Chinese folklore, there's dragons, and they don't seem to be connected. So, like, what's up with that? Did dragons roam the earth?
Yes.
That's a good question.
I mean, according to the six-day creationists, dragons are dinosaurs that knights hunted to extinction in the Middle Ages, and that's why they're not around anymore.
Oh, wow. That's the story, huh?
Uh-huh. Literally. At the Creation Museum in Kentucky, they have a whole room dedicated to that.
Is that as a result of the canopy theory, JR?
Uh-huh. Well, and you know, because the Bible says that Noah took two of every kind of animal onto the ark, and so that means dinosaurs, right, if they existed in the world, mm-hmm, must have been on the ark. Because right, otherwise, you don't believe in the Bible, you heretic.
Baby dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs / dragons.
See, I find a fundamentalist reading of the Bible less interesting than the fact that dragons might have existed.
Yeah, I'm with you there, 100%.
Less fascinating, yes.
Yeah.
What? Why past tense? Could they not still exist today, possibly?
Dragons?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Just checking.
I think so.
Johnny, do you have like a particular favorite cultural incarnation of dragon?
I think that the mythical monsters that we find in the Old Testament are pretty interesting to me. Like they definitely thought, this isn't totally dragon oriented, but they definitely thought there were sea monsters in
like
the water.
Like Leviathan, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally, mm-hmm, you know? And like, I think that's interesting. I like the idea of imaginative creatures and imagining things, because I think it's important for us to cultivate imagination if we're going to have faith. So fantastical thinking is good for the fertility of our faith.
Yeah, I love that. I just not too long ago, one of our listeners, Stacy, recommended a book to me called The Priory of the Orange Tree. And that postulated a world, sort of loosely mapped on ours. There's, you know, the West, which was very like colonialist, monotheist. And then there was the East. And Western dragons were like the fire-breathing, evil, scary ones. And the Eastern dragons were more like the water dragon, friends of humanity, like kind of good. I don't know. It was really interesting. But it was the same kind of thing, right? Like all these different cultures have different dragons.
Wait, good because they like humans? This sounds very human-centric to me.
Well, you know, it was written from a particular perspective, so.
A human perspective.
A dragon didn't write it.
A fire-breathing dragon bent on destroying the world did not write it, as far as I could tell.
Boo.
So sorry about that tangent.
It's all fine.
So Johnny, I'm curious, you're an Anabaptist pastor, which I think shapes a lot of what we find in your new book, Jesus Takes a Side. Did you grow up Anabaptist, or is this something you came to as an adult, or what was your journey into Anabaptist pastoring?
I grew up in central Pennsylvania, so I may as well have grown up Anabaptist because there's a lot of Amish and Mennonite types there, but I did not grow up Anabaptist. But I moved to Philadelphia in 2004, and as an Arab American, 9/11 and the global war on terror really influenced how I saw the world. The jingoism, the xenophobia, and the racism that I experienced formed who I am. I think that our lived experiences form our theology and politics, right? So, like, my parents immigrated to the United States from Egypt, which is suppressive of Christianity, in the 80s. And so they became politically conservative because they moved from a place of being a religious minority to a place of no longer being a religious minority. So their treatment in terms of their faith informed how they work. And, you know, I wish that they would open their eyes to the other hostilities that face them in the U.S., but that's just where they are. Whereas for me, my treatment as a child of immigrants and as an Arab American during the war in Iraq galvanized my resistance to it. Mm-hmm. And I was looking for peacemaking Christians, and I didn't even know they existed.
Wow.
It seemed like I grew up in a conservative enclave, very Republican, very pro-Bush. And this was definitely God's will for us to invade Afghanistan and Iraq. And so I found a peace-loving community, a peacemaking community in Philadelphia, and then became Anabaptist as a result of that. Okay. It just matched my understanding of who Jesus is and was.
Johnny, for our listeners who aren't familiar with the Anabaptist tradition, can you tell us a little bit about that and how that intersects with kind of peace-oriented communities?
So the Anabaptists, it literally means, it used to be a pejorative term, it literally means baptized people. So during the Reformation, they wanted to reform further. They rejected infant baptism or pedo baptism and insisted on people getting baptized as professing adults, people that are professing faith. This got a lot of them killed. But one of the reasons they did so is because they didn't want infants to be baptized into the citizenry of a state church. And so they resisted state church and state power. And when you resist that kind of power, you almost automatically take a peace-loving, non-violent side. And so they were non-violent people, started by Menno Simons and some other early Anabaptists in Europe. And then they immigrated to the United States in farming communities. They lived simple lives, specializing in forgiveness, in piety, and in nonviolence as well. So that informs Anabaptism.
Nice. Thank you.
If you want to read more about it, read The Naked Anabaptist by Stuart Murray. That's a good primer.
Great.
Nice. Well, so your book is called Jesus Takes a Side, Embracing the Political Demands of the Gospel. And as listeners to the show know, we're not going to try to cover the whole book because we would hate to rob you of the joy of reading it for yourself. Yeah. Instead, we want to dive into a couple of specific things. So, Johnny, I'd love if you could tell us, first of all, what you even mean when you say political.
Well, I think that in a sense, political could just refer to matters of national politics. It could refer to state and local politics and matters of government. But when I say political, I mean matters of people, of their livelihood, and how they are materially expressed in the world. So politics is practical. Politics informs our lived experience. And it often relates to matters, sociological matters like race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and so on. So for me, when I say politics, I mean national politics, but I also mean politics that's in our bodies, how we act according to our experiences, and how we take care of one another together as a community.
So when you say in our bodies, you're talking about our physical bodies or like—
Yes, I am.
Okay. Okay.
So within our physical bodies, our lived experiences from our bodies, from our social positions, from the flesh and blood we're made of.
So as we dive into the chapter, I also want you, could you explain to our listeners to what you mean by partisanship?
So in the United States, partisanship means aligning with one of our dominant political parties. So in the United States, we have two. We have Republicans and we have Democrats. Partisan means biased, ultimately, but when we use it in terms of our parties, we're referring to allegiance to political parties. And so that's what partisanship means.
And I want us to clarify, because when we are talking about politics, partisanship, within the context of the church, capital C, and then local C, there are lots of folks who knee-jerk reaction would be, we are not political. Period. We are a church. We are not political. And so the conversation doesn't go beyond even just broadly politics. It can't go the next step into the partisanship part of how we vote and align ourselves. So before 2016, there are many churches, I believe, including yours, that sought to be nonpartisan and apolitical. So can you tell us a little bit about what motivated this and then what happened in 2016?
I think we grow up in a society that says it is impolite to talk about politics, right? There's some subjects we're not supposed to talk about at dinner, like money, religion, sex, politics. I think those are like the most interesting subjects, but people don't want to talk about them. And so it's impolite to talk about who you voted for. And I think that it is convenient to be apolitical, especially if you are in a dominant social position. So for a lot of people, this is why I distinguish between embodied politics and abstract politics. For a lot of people, abstract politics means it doesn't really affect you. At the end of the day, you voted for this person, I voted for this person. Let's not allow it to get between us. And I think for the most part, that's kind of how the world operated in terms of apoliticality in our churches. I think this is probably more true of predominantly white churches, even if they had some minority representation. In predominantly white churches, there's largely a comfort with not being political, and even a sense of pride for having a purple congregation where people with different philosophies and different ideas can come together in peace, as if that is the purpose of the gospel. I always think this was true. This was not the vision of discipleship in Jesus, but I think it became apparent in 2016 because the manifest evil of an objectively white supremacist president became obvious to us. Because Donald Trump was so flagrantly racist, specifically flagrantly sexist, you know, the language he used that was recorded on the one talk show, the locker room talk, you know, it was so like obviously wrong. When he called immigrants, you know, rapists and drug dealers and things like that, right? It's so obviously wrong. It's so kind of flamboyant in its cruelty that people are like, oh, yes. Oh, politics isn't abstract. This isn't just an idea that we can set aside. If you're an immigrant or a woman and someone vocally supports Trump, they're vocally dehumanizing you. Yeah. Right. So these things can't go hand in hand any longer. And I think that gave us a lens from which to see the world. I think that the civil rights movement saw this. I think the abolition movement saw this. I think that throughout history, we saw examples of this. But I think for the relative peace between, you know, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, it was not as apparent. You know, for me, it was apparent during the Bush administration. But at the end of the day, when you have Mitt Romney and Barack Obama on the ticket, it's not as readily apparent, right? When the discussion is between healthcare called Romney Care in Massachusetts and it's just expanded to a federal level and it's called Obamacare, well, it looks pretty similar. You're both pretty centrist, kind of neoliberal types. one of you is black, so we will vote for you because representation really matters. It really is significant, but it looks like two sides of the same coin.
You know, I grew up in primarily fundamentalist and conservative, largely white congregations. And there was a lot of talk about being apolitical and nonpartisan, but also it was made really clear that Christians voted Republican. You never say that from the pulpit, but
totally.
That was, I don't even know how they did it. It was like in the water. You understood that was reality. Like, any thoughts on that? Well, how is that supposed nonpartisanship kind of disguising, though, that you're actually all on one side?
I mean, I do think that in terms of white evangelicals, it's clear that they're partisan.
Yeah.
You know, so like the idea that a white evangelical would say that, I mean, 82% of them voted for Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, and more of them voted for Donald Trump in 2020. So the idea that they're not political or not partisan is kind of a joke, you know, to me. Do you think that those are the folks that suggest that they're apolitical?
Oh, that was overtly said in churches I grew up in. We don't take sides on politics.
But they are. Yeah, you want to say something, JR?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, so I pastor in Texas. When I came to the church where I am, they boasted about being a purple church.
Mm.
But I would say that they were maroon at best.
So pretty red. So.
Yeah, they were. And I mean, that was it, right? Like they were overwhelmingly red. But the story that they told themselves was because they never talked about, and the pastor that I followed, he literally once a year stood up in front of the congregation and told everyone, don't talk about politics because we want to be a church for everyone. Right. So they had convinced themselves that because they just never talked about politics, they were full-throatedly bipartisan and purple, when actually the reality was that was not the case.
Mm.
They were, I mean, again, I never sat down to count, but if it was better than 80-20, I would be shocked, and I bet it was closer to 90-10.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me.
The town I grew up in, my friend's pastor of a pretty large church would always say he wasn't political. And then there was a local kind of LGBT-ish thing being put forward in the city. We're on the outskirts of San Francisco. And he said, well, the church doesn't take a position on either side, but on Sunday afternoon, a bus rolled up for people to go protest. And, you know, they just announced, there's a bus if you want to participate in this, but we're not political. And then he ended up running for a city councilor, you know, and
participating in an anti-LGBTQ.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the bus, that's where the bus would take you. Right. That's not what the city ordinance was like. It was basically a non-bigotry thing.
Oh, okay.
And they were like, anyway, no, we want to be bigoted.
Yes.
I mean, right. They would never use that terminology. And that's the thing, right? We're just talking about what is God's best for people, blah, 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 blah. Anyway,
I think people don't see their politics when they think that they are morally superior, right?
Right.
Like, this is biblical. I'm not political. I'm biblical, and this is how I read the Bible. I think that's how people think. Whereas I think we should just embrace the fact that everything is political and then sort our lives that way, as opposed to suggesting that politics is bad and we're not political, and we get our values. Like, it's just a different descriptor for our values, you know?
Well, and it assumes that somehow we live outside of the reality that we are all in, and that just because we have a Bible that we say we occasionally read, that somehow our worldview is untainted.
Sure, absolutely.
Right? And the way we live is untainted, and so therefore we are morally superior, and therefore we are not political, but that has never been my experience, even though even in the predominantly Asian American church we were a part of, I'd say 20 years ago, the pastor straight up was like, well, if you need to vote for the right party, right? And we're like, what in the world? I remember Peter and I sitting next to each other going, oh, he just said it out loud. So,
Johnny, I think wrapped up in all this is particularly, I would say, in the last decade and accelerating after 2016, we hear calls for civility and politeness, which I think goes along with that. You know, we want to be nonpartisan. We want to be apolitical. We want to meet welcome. In the middle and bridge the divide and blah, blah, blah. But in one of your chapters, you suggest that the impulse towards civility or politeness can actually hamper the church's call to truth-telling. So
absolutely.
Are you telling my sweet little old grandmother, may she rest in peace, that the truth is not polite?
No, I don't think it is. You know, I don't. I think that truth can be polite, but I don't think it is beholden to politeness. I think that we should be uncomfortable by the truth. It should convict us. It should move us. It should shake us, you know. But also, for the oppressed, it should comfort us. And so there's this, if it just placates us, if it just gives us this false sense of peace, then I don't think we're talking about the darkness of the soul or really the reality of our existence, you know? Like, and it just keeps going. Like, why should we be polite after 19 kids die in Uvalde? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's no tangible action. Like, mm-hmm. is that really the time for civility? Mm-hmm. What are we talking about? You know, yeah. when you see George Floyd get murdered because Derek Chauvin, you know, choked him with his knee for 9 minutes. If the first thing you're saying is we want to be civil, you're missing the point. You know, James Cone in the book says, I mean, I quote a passage where he argues that when you tell us to be civil, when you tell us not to protest or even not to riot, you're saying, we're not going to give you your freedom. We're going to keep killing you and torturing you and raping you until you behave yourself. You know, that kind of lack of empathy and understanding of the oppressed's struggle, you know. I think, honestly, that given their experience, people who are harmed in the United States have acted very civilly, given what they've experienced, that they are gracious. You know, I used to say just specifically about race, like if people of color reacted as poorly to instances of racism as white people did to accusations of racism, it would be a wild world. Yeah. You know, like as a person of color, sometimes you just want to go to the grocery store. And so you just absorb the hits that you need to take and then you get home, you know? But if you call if you name a white person's action as racist, it's as if you've tossed an epithet towards them, offended them deeply.
Yeah. It's the white tears, right?
Mm-hmm,
The reaction to that, the pointing out of offensive behavior actually changes the dynamic once that white person starts to emote, and it's exhausting. But I, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's the hard thing is because as a woman of color, I have behaved, and most days I do just want to go to the grocery store because I'm there every day right. because my grown sons just eat a lot of food. That my politeness is mistaken for agreement to that kind of behavior, that somehow totally. I must always be okay with that kind of social contract. So then if I step outside of those bounds, even by a little bit, then it's, oh, well, how dare you? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How dare you? And I find it has been historically worse in churches, in Christian circles. The ways in which hurt feelings are more important than the actual sexism, racism, ableism.
Absolutely. You know, I think that we justify a lot of white anger and white anger from men. And when mm-hmm. minorities push back against it, they are really vilified. I mean, especially Black women, right?
Yes.
Like if a Black woman makes the wrong face,
yes.
there's all this resistance. Whereas, you know, white men can get really angry, you know? and we justify it. We allow it.
Yeah.
So, Johnny, on the one hand, we're talking about how churches have said they're nonpartisan. Some of them have been. Some have been saying they're nonpartisan when they're actually taking a side, but like politely hiding it and saying everyone's welcome here, but vote for the right candidate, right? I hear you saying, and I think you say in the book that there, that maybe there actually is a right side. Jesus takes sides. We should take sides. Is that right?
That's right. In the United States, bipartisanship has largely maintained the status quo.
Yeah.
When the parties come together and agree, it usually is because it's business as usual. So when bills enjoy bipartisan support, they get praised, right? Like Joe Biden has like terminal Senate brain.
Yeah.
So he calls everything, even with like one Republican voting, a bipartisan bill, because that makes people feel good. Look, cooperation across the aisle. This is happening.
Everyone agrees, but, yeah.
But it often removes the teeth out of the legislation. It often makes the impact less, and it maintains the status quo. But in our history, we've needed partisanship to advance progress. And so the right side isn't a partisan side. The right side is the side that uplifts and honors the oppressed. This is my argument, that it gives dignity to people that don't have it. It gives dignity to people who bear the image of God, but who bear an injury to that very image greater than other people. It gives dignity to people who are self-emptied and must be uplifted, to the least of these, to the little ones among us, right? It fills valleys, it lowers hills. It lowers hills, it makes things equal. And so that is how our politics should be oriented. It should be an intersectional politics that considers people's race, class, ability, gender, sexuality, and tries to uplift them as equals. That's what should inform our politics. And sometimes, especially in the United States and other areas, that will make us incidentally partisan. But it's only an incident. It's only incidentally partisan. It's not intentionally partisan. So I think that sometimes we see, and this happened a lot in the Trump administration, we see consistent opposition to Trump. And they say, well, you're so partisan because you always disagree with Trump. Well, of course I do. This is, it's like saying you always disagree with Nazis, right? Like you should always do that. You know, yes. I don't know why, you know. Well, you never have to like hand it to them. You never have to hand it to ISIS, right? It's always bad, right? You know. So I think that's how clear it was. And that's not even to say that Democrats are good,
right?
You know? Right.
Like I in the book later on, I talk about how voting for Joe Biden was really hard for me, and that the Democrats not investigating a sexual allegation against him showed that they have no moral leadership. Like, maybe you're the better of two options, but you're certainly not moral leaders, you know, because you're not consistent, whatever, you know, you're interested in your power. So I vote for you with trembling, but nevertheless, it appears incidentally partisan.
Well, and the Democrats, I mean, like you said, status quo, right? And the fact is all our politicians are at the top of the status quo. So why do they want to change it? And we see things like the recent shootings, the many recent shootings.
Absolutely.
And we're like, oh, the Republicans are making money off the gun lobby. But I got a bunch of fundraising emails from all the Democrats who haven't managed to do anything also. They're also making a bunch of money off it. And there's a reason certain things don't move forward when they actually could, is that, yeah, there's enormous power moving behind the scenes, not even always behind the scenes, where people are making money or entrenching themselves more deeply into power.
Totally.
Anyway, sorry. I had a soapbox, apparently.
That's good. John, that's good.
I think one of the rhetorical tics that we hear in the church a lot is that we have to remember that there are, you know, many fine people on both sides, to quote our white supremacist president of late. And again, I think I understand in the abstract why pastors and some Christians want to do that. But again, you suggest that that's actually really gets in the way of our ability to tell the truth. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. There was a famous, we'll say neo-Anabaptist pastor from the Midwest who bragged about having undocumented immigrants and ICE agents in his church. First of all, don't tell the ICE agents there's undocumented immigrants in your church. Like, that's just like a basic thing, right? Like, why are you doing that?
It's a mistake.
But also, those identities are not equal. They're not comparable, right? You're talking about people who are cool with forced deportation, right? Mm-hmm. And then the actual people, the immigrants, not even the people that are against it. We're not talking about two abstractions. We're talking about people, their livelihood, and then people who have an idea to oppose them, right? You're talking about people who think it's okay for police to kill Black people and not people who oppose the killing of Black people, people who are Black, you know? So it's completely imbalanced, you know? The church is an opportunity for reconciliation. It's an opportunity for all of us to come to the table, but there's a cost to it. You know, right before the words of institution in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul says, "Your rich come, get drunk at the love feast, eat all the food, and then the people from the field come and they don't eat anything. Why don't you eat at home? You have means. You come here, you eat the whole banquet, and then you humiliate people who have nothing." That's his speech before coming to the table. That's the reconciling speech. So Jesus gives us all a chance to come to the table. And it looks lopsided to some people because the oppressed have a vacancy in their hearts because it's not filled with power. It's not filled with money. It's not filled with greed that Jesus can fill more easily. It is good news for the oppressed, and it is good news for the oppressor. It's just painful news for the oppressor. There's a bigger cost to it, right? The parable of the great banquet does the same thing. He invites the well-to-do, the people who are married, the people who have new oxen, the people who have a new field, and they can't come because they're too busy. So go invite who's available to come. And so I do think that there is a reconciling place at the table, but I think you do need to transform. You know, this isn't, we're not finding a table with so-called blue lives and then Black lives, because we can't take off our skin color. You can take off your uniform. Mm-hmm. They're different things. You are not ontologically a police. You're not even ontologically, you know, whiteness isn't even an ontological characteristic, you know? Right. It's a totally different idea and power. And so for me, there is room at the table. And pastors need to face their flocks as they can. But my experience is elevate the voices of minorities, elevate the voices of the marginalized, help us to listen to them. And then allow the people in power the discomfort of it, you know, let them lead us, as opposed to just trying to correct all the powerful people, the privileged people. Uplift the marginalized. Let's listen to them. Let's let them lead us. That's going to transform our churches.
I'm not sure that churches want to be transformed.
Kathy, what do you mean?
I'm grumpy.
Say more, Kathy.
Well,
what do you mean?
You know, I think it is that the lure of power and status quo has benefited certain folks for so long. Why give that up?
Mm.
Right? So it is easier, even in this time of so many white evangelicals going through deconstruction. What I see are similar structures being rebuilt outside of evangelicalism with the same power structures, the same white people leading with a different voice, with a different viewpoint on things than they had maybe 10, 20 years ago. But it feels the same. It was all disrupted with the pandemic. There were things that were, you know, starting to build momentum and then pandemic. So then those conferences couldn't happen and those gatherings couldn't happen. But it was so interesting to see the same patterns of power and influence replicate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, things paused because we couldn't gather, people couldn't travel. And yet that still didn't take into consideration there were always people who couldn't travel.
Absolutely.
Who couldn't attend those conferences, who didn't care about those books, who had never heard about these people. And yet now folks are kind of, recreating themselves with a different viewpoint, but it's the same thing. It just feels like the same thing. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say I'm not convinced that churches really want that. I think a lot of churches are far more comfortable saying, we welcome everyone, as in literally you can walk through the door if you can walk through the door. And that's about as far as we're going to go. And then any level of discomfort that you may feel within the walls and the places in which our church people gather, if you're not comfortable, that's on you. That's mm-hmm. that's not on the church.
Churches like that, that unity that they try mm-hmm. to go for, it falls yeah. falls in the back of the oppressed. We feel it. And mm-hmm. so if that's the kind of church you want to have, then understand that even if you have minorities in the church, they feel the weight in a different capacity. And I know a lot of churches are like that, Kathy. And so like, yeah. I'm not going to say they all want to be transformed. But if a pastor is convicted by the evil around them, but is anxious about talking about it with their congregation because they think they'll lose half of them, well, there's a path forward. You don't have to just bend your knee. You can actually speak in a way, you know. Yeah. And if our churches close because we tried to exorcise the demons of patriarchy and white supremacy and homophobia, so be it. You know, the cancer grew too much. I'm sorry. That sounds awful, but that has to be the case, you know, mm-hmm. because some things just aren't worth saving.
Yeah.
And if you can't heal, then what are we doing? You know, why are we still doing this?
Johnny, can you talk a little bit about, like, I think all three of us hosts have had moments in our different communities where we've spoken out on different topics and faced some I think opposition is a fair word. that's fair, right? What, fair. Johnny, when your church, when you started guiding your people toward becoming partisan, taking a side, was that uncomfortable? Were people upset? Did you get people pushing back against you? Like, what was your experience?
Not to be dramatic, but we helped our church become LGBT affirming and anti-racist, anti-oppression. We're still on that journey.
Wow.
It basically split the church in half. And we're a progressive church in blue Philadelphia. Yeah. I want people to know that even though our church, if you took account of everyone, almost everyone would have voted against Trump. Even then, there was still a tremendous tension. And it was very hard. You know, I felt it very personally. I felt scapegoated. I was named as the problem, you know? So like, I certainly felt it. It was not a comfortable experience for me whatsoever. And you know, I believed that it wasn't just me leading this effort. We had a coalition of people in a diverse community leading this effort, but yeah, absolutely. There was a tremendous amount of tension and difficulty. And a lot of resistance from powerful families in the church, from powerful people in the church. And, you know, this is really a subject for another book, but certainly I faced that. I and others have faced that backlash, oppression, scapegoating.
Yeah, thanks.
I think that just goes to show that majority culture, whether that's men or white people or straight cis people, you know, whatever. I keep calling it the get out liberalism, right? We're the nice progressive majority culture people. We love having you here so long as you continue to function as a tool for our advancement, not as a true peer partner, you know, ally. And so, yeah, I think I'm
totally,
I don't know, having lived through and continuing to live through something similar with my own congregation. Yeah, it's really painful to see folk who talk a big talk about justice work and loving all people and radical hospitality decide they're more comfortable somewhere else when you actually ask them to do those things.
Absolutely. Yeah, you absolutely. Know?
I knew a man in ministry who was a big proponent of people of color in a variety of ways, well known as an advocate, up until the moment that it was suggested that he step aside and let a person of color lead.
Mm-hmm.
And then it all came apart in the most dramatic and horrific kind of earth burning kind of way. Like, I'd rather destroy this ministry than step aside kind of thing. It was really, I'm sure it wasn't shocking to many of the people of color, but it was really shocking to me. I was like, I had no idea. I thought this person, they were saying all the right things, but their heart wasn't transformed. I think at the end of the day is part of it. You know, there was a selfishness there. Yeah.
Totally. We had the same experience too. A lot of people think, a lot of progressive white guys think, hey, I've made it. I've done it. But stepping aside to let someone else lead is often just really hard for them. Mm-hmm. And the false sense of persecution really comes up.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. Mm. Wow.
So earlier on, when we asked you what fascinated you, you talked about dragons. We're not going to go into dragons. We're going to talk about imagination, right? Because you also mentioned that, right? This having an imaginative mind is imperative in faith. So what role does bipartisanship play in the American imagination?
Well, I think it really limits our imagination. It limits the possibilities for what we think can happen. It constrains our political imagination. If what we think is possible is only what these two parties can agree on, then we have a very narrow framework for what is politically possible. And that maintains the status quo. It really does mean we're looking at an eternal income pay gap between men and women, right? We're looking at disproportionately more incarceration for Black people. You know, the things that just make up our society, that's how it is. A planet that is going to destroy civilization, right? These are the things that'll continue. Bipartisanship keeps the ship going the way that it is, and it limits our imagination. And so in many ways, we should resist bipartisanship and increase the intensity of partisanship, that we should actually ally and move to change the world in these ways. But, you know, more than that, I mean, I think even within our political economy, if we take a side as the parties have been laid out, we also constrain our imaginations. Following Jesus gives us such a great imagination for what's possible. It gives us a counterconsciousness and an ability to think in brand new ways, ways that don't even make sense. And to enact that, we certainly cannot reduce ourselves to making sure we meet across the aisle.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, I'm thinking a lot about that right now, simply because of current events, right? And the gun lobby and trying to fight for common sense gun laws. And what do we exactly mean by common sense gun laws? Because clearly we can't agree on that. And that feeling of nothing is going to get done because it is so partisan. So then the language pushes to what kind of bipartisan agreement can be passed? What can actually change? And I think when I was reading that chapter, there was a bit of me bristling just because the reality feels like, well, if it's not bipartisan, it's not going to get the vote. It won't actually move into law. And then I had to stop and think, okay, well, are there ways to think beyond only the laws changing?
Totally.
And then I got stuck. It was like, oh, can I think that way? Would that actually allow for change?
So there is there's a gun control bill right now that's passed the House. It just happened, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to get stuck in the Senate, most likely.
Yeah.
Now, why is it going to get stuck in the Senate? Because of the filibuster rule.
Yeah.
The Senate is already a minority. Now we're going to, can I talk about politics? This
yeah.
The, oh, Senate, yes. The Senate's already a very minoritarian institution because California has two senators and so does Wyoming. Right. And they have just a huge, I mean, California is 10% right. of the country.
It's big.
Wyoming is tiny. So like, it's already protects minoritarian interests. It already protects the voice of the minority. It's not majoritarian. But the filibuster makes it even worse because what it does is it requires a 60-vote threshold to get anything passed. And so it allows Republicans who are generally elected from states that have less people in them, it allows them to have more power to stop legislation. There are 50 votes in the Senate that could pass gun control legislation. What stands in their way is the filibuster. And we need to do something about that, you know, and we know, you know, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema don't want to do something. And so we have a false majority. Really, we have 52 Republicans based on yes. how they act. So yes. yes, it is frustrating. And there are, and the filibuster is a rule that helps maintain the status quo. It's, and it's actually a racist rule that has kept civil rights legislation from advancing. That's exactly how it's been used.
It came about, yeah.
yeah. And it's been abused that way too. And so we're facing with the same issue. It does seem like it is gridlocked and impossible, but it isn't because of polarization. It isn't because the country is polarized. It's because we have actual political processes that keep things from moving along.
Right. Yeah, you hear a lot, right? The system's not broken. It's functioning the way it was designed to function.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah. I particularly enjoyed this bit of your chapter, and so I wondered if you'd just indulge me for the sake of our listeners. You were talking about how the goal ought likely not be bipartisanship, but rather not only partisanship, but a radicalized partisanship. And I thought you did a really interesting thing in talking about Jesus and the Sadducees versus the Pharisees, and Jesus, where Jesus locates himself in that. Would you mind talking about that, maybe preaching about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I mean, I do think that it can be helpful for us to look at the sects of Judaism that Josephus talks about, the Essenes, the Zealots, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees, and understanding how Jesus took a side. For the most part, Jesus seems to have trained by the Pharisees. They didn't fall into very explicit camps. And some of that is like a little bit of anachronism, but because the Pharisees end up being the sect that continues, but Jesus really resists Sadduceical Judaism and has a gentle critique in my reading of the Pharisees. You know, he follows ritual purity. He follows the Jewish law. He's just lamenting a hypocrisy in it. He's lamenting that they look clean on the outside, but they're dirty on the inside. He's lamenting that these people of Jerusalem didn't follow him. And so there's a lamentation because people dear to him didn't follow. But I think that when it comes to the sort of action Jesus engaged in, and again, in the Bible, the religious and the political are largely synonymous. We have an odd distinction, but they're very connected in the text. And so I think Jesus definitely expresses not meeting in the middle between these two political parties, but rather siding with the Pharisees. And they were friends, you know. The Pharisees warned Jesus that Herod wanted to kill him. You know, they warned Jesus during the triumphal entry, hey, quiet your disciples down because they're causing an uprising and it's going to get us killed. You know, they're like the black mother telling their black son, hey, cool it around cops. It's not going to go well for us. And I think it's important for us to see the alliance between Jesus and the Pharisees in the Gospels. And just as a separate idea, try not to use Pharisee as a pejorative term, because the Jews that we know today are from the Pharisaical tradition.
Well, and we even see Jesus... again, maybe anachronistic to say this, but like radicalizing some of the Pharisaical teachings, right?
Yes,
like
that's what I argue, yeah.
He's like pressing us even further. What an ancient Jewish person would have understood is like further afield of Pharisaism, not closer to Sadduceeism.
Yep, absolutely.
So is that like, I'm thinking like Sermon on the Mount, where he's, you've heard it said, but I say...
That's what I would say. It was a midrash on the law, and he had a way of intensifying it.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Well, Johnny, this has been amazing. It's been so good. I honestly think...
I really appreciate that.
I just want to say, like, you know, I love JR and Kathy and know them both well, so I expect them to, like, fall in certain places because we're old friends, right? But to hear another pastor come on the show and talk in the way you're talking, getting a little emotional, but it just gives me hope. So thank you.
Well, I'm so glad for that, Matt.
Having said that, for those who would like more Johnny Rashid, there is your book, of course, but if they want to find you online, where can they connect?
JohnnyRashid.com, and then you can follow me at Johnny Rashid on Instagram and Twitter as well.
Awesome.
Wonderful. No TikTok?
No TikTok yet.
Not yet. Kathy's got to go first. That's the rule in our house.
I have an account.
Oh,
I have not done anything with it. I'm trying to... I want to ruin it for my children.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Johnny, our sort of closing ritual for the show that we always invite our guests into is that we each pick something that has been fascinating us lately in pop culture. It can be, you know, a book, an album, a TV show, a movie, or, you know, just something that you can't get off your mind lately. Since you're the guest, we let you go last since we spring it on you. So, Matt, why don't you tell us what is fascinating you this week?
You know, Micah, my 12-year-old, and I watched Ms. Marvel yesterday, the new Disney Marvel show that just came out. And I have mixed feelings about most of the Marvel TV shows. And this one, of course, I've only seen the first episode. But it was so refreshing to me that it wasn't about the military-industrial complex. It was about a young adult, a person of color, who was just delightful and funny and enjoyable and wrestling with really relatable human family issues while also, you know, being transformed into someone who's going to save the world. And there, I won't give you any spoilers, but there's a really beautiful moment where Ms. Marvel says... Well, she's not Miss Marvel yet. The young woman says, it's not brown girls from Jersey who saved the world. And her best friend, who's this white boy from school, says, don't say that. He says, that's not true. And it's really beautiful. And it was fun to watch it with my 12-year-old. And we both were laughing and just enjoying it a lot. It's one of the, yeah, it's on track. If it sticks to what it's doing, it could very well be my favorite of the Marvel TV shows for sure. So yeah, Ms. Marvel, you were probably going to watch it anyway, but now I can say that I told you to. How about you, Kathy?
I loved that. I watched it last night too. It was really good. So this may not be on everybody's radar, but, Peter and I watched, Fire Island the other day.
I've been curious about this.
Yes. And, I wasn't sure. And it was a delightful rom-com.
Oh, really?
In the truest sense. It's about kind of a maid family, a queer family, and they go to a real-life place called Fire Island off of New York. It's a real place because we Googled all of it. We were like, wait, what is this? What's going on? It's this annual ritual that they have. They go for this like long weekend kind of getaway. And the timing is great because Peter and I we're watching this in between our mutual weekend getaways that we have with our respective group of friends. And what is amazing is that this features and centers Asian American gay men. And I didn't know what to expect. And there were parts of the, you know, not finding romantic love or not feeling like you fit into that social space, even though that's your only social space in which you might find love, because you are Asian, you're an Asian gay man, it hit both of us. Peter and I were sitting there like, ooh, this, wow. I thought I had gotten over that trauma and that kind of experience of knowing, like, I'm never going to get asked out, period, kind of thing. Directed by an Asian American man and written by, I believe. So there are a lot of levels to it. It's not for everyone, blah, blah, blah. Rom-com may not be your thing. And it also caused I never know how to pronounce it. Is it the Bechdel?
Bechdel
test.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was trending the other day because of this movie. A white woman tweeted out how movie did not. Yeah.
Because there are no women in the movie to speak of.
There is a woman, but it apparently this white woman watched it and said it doesn't pass the Bechdel test.
Really?
And then Twitter just took her tweet down, which also then caused another kind of thing. But you all can read up on that and figure out why that was just so dumb. That was a dumb move.
Yeah. Example of someone who we were talking about, the kind of white liberal,
is
about feminism, et cetera, not seeing that it's also marginalizing another population. Yeah.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. So Fire Island.
Oh, awesome.
Love it.
How about you, JR?
Well, I was gonna talk about Obi-Wan, but I fell asleep halfway through typing the title into the show notes. So I decided instead to talk about something that's actually good, which is the new Christina Aguilera album titled Aguilera. And it is an entirely in Spanish album.
Oh, wow.
And it is, it's just great. I can't quit listening to it. Half of it is like, kind of like Shakira-esque pop ballad stuff. There's a couple of real banging ballads on there. And then there's some stuff at the end that's like way more traditional Mexican music. And it's just a great album. So, yeah, Christina Aguilera, new album. Nice. Who would have thought? Not me, for sure. So, but it's great. So, Johnny, what do you got for us?
I kind of want to defend Obi-Wan now.
Yeah, do it.
Oh, please feel free.
I liked Obi-Wan.
I'll happily. If you're a vegetarian, I can understand why you dig it, because there's no steaks at all.
Get out.
No, I want to share a different thing, but I do like Obi-Wan. There's this story. It's called The Arabic Quilt, and it came out in 2021, and it's by Aya Khalil, and it's about this Egyptian immigrant. Do you know the story, Kathy?
I haven't read it, but I have heard.
As a child of immigrants, there's a passage that very deeply spoke to me that I want to share with you. It's a picture book, so it's pretty simple. But there's ayah, or ayah, which means verse in Arabic. She's eating breakfast. Here's how it goes. Breakfast is delicious. Egyptian fava beans, we call that ful medemmes, homemade French toast and watermelon with feta cheese and mint. Zachariah has watermelon juice dripping down his chin. He looks happy. I packed your favorite lunch for you, a kofta sandwich, Baba exclaims, which is like a spiced meat sandwich. Shukran, Baba, Kenzie says. But secretly, she wishes her Baba would pack her a peanut butter and jelly sandwich instead. Her family has just moved to town, and she doesn't know anyone, and she doesn't want to be different. Like that, that experience of the child of immigrants, of like just having the unusual lunch and wanting to fit in, is so palpable to me. It's so like important to me. It really speaks my experience. Like, my mom made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in like pita bread. And that felt unusual for me, but that's the bread that we had, so that's what we used. And that not fitting in, that pressure to try to fit in, but never quite make it, that's really what I hope can be how our churches work, how Jesus followers work, where we do try to include people who have been excluded and center their experiences and hold them close. So for me, this story really touched me, and it fascinated me, as it were.
Wow. Thank you, Johnny. Thank you so much. And again, thank you for being on the show with us, for your graciousness, your vulnerability. It's been a really terrific interview. So thank you.
So happy to be here. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Listeners, again, our guest has been Pastor Johnny Rashid. His book is called Jesus Takes a Side. It is available now wherever you can find books. It is from Herald Press. Please make sure you get the book. You'll love it, I promise. You probably don't need any more convincing after the interview, but reach out to Johnny. Let him know you enjoyed having him on the show. And until next week, take care of each other out there. Be safe, be well, and continue to be kind, but not necessarily polite.